When I was growing up, the joke to say something was obviously true was to ask rhetorically, well, is the Pope Catholic? Apparently he's not anymore. Also, what happens if there's a tie in the upcoming election? On this week's Corey Truax Show. And when I say tie, I mean an actual electoral college tie. I have a very realistic scenario that I want to share with you, and then a little fun fact that I forgot about what happens if there is an electoral college tie. And the outcome is, I think, for anybody, it's kind of funny on how that actually works out. I have several other things I want to do, and I do want to keep it more brief than usual. Shows are usually 40 minutes. I like to keep it shorter this week because tomorrow I'll be recording, if all goes according to plan and the Lord allows, I'll be sitting down with Cody Fields for another edition of Those Conversations He and I Have, so there's more content coming your way on this feed and on his. And so we'll try to keep it a little bit more brief this week. Welcome to the Corey Truax Show, wherever you find podcasts. I'm glad you're here. Thanks for giving me time every week. I am grateful for it. Amongst many other things, I get to serve the awesome people of Beechwood Church. Beechwood Church meets at 10:30 on Sunday mornings in Greenville. You can keep an ear out here because we'll be doing some renovations on our facility coming up here soon. And so we'll be meeting somewhere else for a little while those renovations take place. But anyway, we meet on Sunday mornings, and you're invited. We'd love to have you out any given Sunday morning. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Threads. Look for me, Corey Truax. I don't post much on most of those places, but you can find me there and send me things you think should be covered on the show or opinions you have or ways in which you think I am wrong. I may or may not respond to those, but would love to have your comments there. You can follow along. And Corey Truax Show at gmail.com. Corey Truax Show at gmail.com. I just want to start here. I don't like the feeling of unease I had when I woke up Monday morning and found out, it is Monday today, that the president of Iran died in that helicopter crash. I'm not sad of his going. He was a butcher and a murderer and a destabilizing force on the planet. I had this really, a very quick kick to the gut. It lasted 10 seconds, but just a recognition of, oh man, I hope that does not cause more destabilization, because I immediately went, oh, Israel killed him, because Iran just greenlit and took part in a bombardment that didn't work of Israel. It would be, I would argue, a legitimate act of state to assassinate the person who tried to murder a bunch of your countrymen through that warfare, or to kill a bunch of your people through that warfare, and who did sign off and approve of and fund the killing of 1,200 of your people, because Iran is obviously funding and taking care of Hamas and other anti-Israel forces. I'm asking you to actually pray with your family for just peace. We don't want wars, especially as I get older and realize that the big wars have involved conscription. My two boys are of conscripting age. I guess I still am barely, but they are of conscripting age. You know, I think of World War I because I am a bit of an historian. And the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand was really the step one in a cascading set of events that led to one of the bloodiest interdictions and conflicts of the war in world history, World War I. So I am just asking you, pray for peace. The death of Ibrahim Raisi is currently the president of Iran, currently viewed as an accident, a freak accident that happened in the hills of Iran. I sure am hopeful that's what happened, because I don't want any destabilization on this planet. We got too much of it as it is. All right, two more stories in that kind of vein, and then I want to talk straight politics a little bit here. The Pope did an interview with 60 Minutes, and this clip I'm about to play for you has made its way through the Christian talk show circles, but I want to say my piece on it as well. It's a core doctrine that we have to get correct, and so when a big figure who's considered part of the Christian world, I mean, Catholicism is very large worldwide. The Pope is significant in that way. He said something just doctrinally backward, so I want you to hear that he said it and then correct it so that we all know what we should think about this. Here is Pope Francis talking about what we might call original sin or the depravity of man. We really are now questioning, what is man's natural state? Here is the Pope. I think, yeah, he's Pope Francis. I forgot his real name.
When you look at the world, what gives you hope?
Todo.
everything.
Uno ve tragedia.
You see tragedies.
Pero ve,
but you also see so many beautiful things.
Cosas lindas. Uno ve madres heroicas.
You see heroic mothers.
One, what a bad answer. What gives you hope? The sovereignty of God, that's what gives me hope. That an all-powerful, sovereign God is overseeing all things, that even in the most chaotic moments, I have faith, belief, confidence, con fide, with confidence, believing the Lord is in control.
Hombre heroico.
Heroic men, men who have hopes and dreams,
mujeres que miran
women
adelante.
Who look to the future,
eso a mí me
that
da
gives
esperanza.
Me a lot of hope.
La gente quiere vivir.
People want to live.
La gente.
What a really meaningless set of words. What a meaningless word salad. Your hope is in humanity, in a set of humans that just looks towards the future, that are future-oriented. You can be future-oriented without having any biblical thinking at all.
People forge ahead, and people are fundamentally good.
That's our problem. People are fundamentally good. Let's finish the clip.
We are all fundamentally good.
Yes,
there are some rogues and sinners, but the heart itself is good.
I mean, very specifically, that phrase, the heart itself is good. That's Jeremiah 17:9. No, wait, 33. Yeah, 17:9. The heart is desperately wicked. Above all things, I believe that that verse ends with, who can know it? Who can know the heart of man? It's desperately wicked. It is twisted towards its own ends and not towards serving others. Romans tells us that all have sinned. Everybody falls short of the glory of God. The story of Genesis tells us that, yes, our state before the fall of man, before Satan lies to humanity and says, did God really say? And then we doubt God's goodness. We doubt God's care for us and rebel against his rule. We have a new nature now. As I've been preaching through Hebrews, I got to talk about renewed consciences, that our consciences now are corroded. There's something wrong with the signal sending. Like our sins, because eternity is written on our hearts, our sins will send a signal to our spirit, to our conscience, that say, stop doing that. It's not good. It's not good for you. It's not glorifying to God. Our consciences send a signal of guilt, but over time they just get more corroded and the signal is not as sharp and we can just go on in our sin. So just very quickly from Jeremiah, from Romans, from Genesis, biblically to this Pope, no, we're not. We're not fundamentally good. This one should not be hard. We are fundamentally sinful. And also you should know this secondarily from experience. You first know it by the authority of Scripture. You secondarily know it by experience. We don't have to train vice. We only have to train virtue. I mean, you might even have a really decent-hearted kid. I don't mean that, and their nature's sinless. They just seem caring. They take care of their younger siblings well. They're compliant. They do what you ask. Can I tell you that was me? I barely remember my childhood, but I was super compliant. I really wanted to do what my mom and dad said. And I don't know if I cared well. I mean, I was the third or fourth kid, so I can't say I cared well for my siblings. It was not often my responsibility. But amongst other kids, generally well-liked and was helpful. But why? Even those good deeds were, I could kind of tell fairly early on in my teen years, I'm doing all this to get approval. I don't know if I even really care about these people. I don't know if my heart is at all for my classmate, my teammate on a basketball team, this random person at work that otherwise gets shunned by others that I'm always trying to include. I don't know if my motivations at all are for the image of God on these people and I'm trying to serve it, or if I'm just getting as many people as possible to like me, if I'm getting as many people as possible to approve of me. Listen, I can see that even with I'm around a lot of kids a lot because I'm in a church with young families. And you can see decent-natured kids, and they are so fun because they are compliant and they do the right things and they are so helpful. But even when a kid is like that, often that's what they're trying to manipulate in their life. They're trying to manipulate out of others' approval because they, or even sometimes, some of them are quite wily, they're trying to manipulate something they want, an item, a treat. You know, that's this idea of the heart not being wicked, that he says the heart itself is good. Biblically, we know it's not true, but also our experience tells us that. We got to train most of our kids not to lie, not to hit each other, not to be a glutton. We have to teach them the right things. Their instincts are to sin. And even the kids who are compliant and tend to do the right things, they're often doing it for reasons not to the glory of God. And so one quick word to the Pope there. He couldn't be more wrong, and it's important that we know that. It's important that we start our anthropology, our understanding of humanity, what it is to be human. Is that, yes, we are made in God's image. That is glorious. And we are marred by sin. Then through regeneration, repentance, faith, responding to grace through repentance and faith, a regenerated spirit, over time being more sanctified, becoming more like Jesus, that flesh gets weaker, the spirit gets stronger, and then we can do the right things for right reasons with right thinking. Which leads me to one last quite biblical spiritual thought before doing politics from a biblical perspective, but this more clearly straight up biblical spiritual thinking. We have arrived in the time of the calendar where it is vacation season. It's Memorial Day weekend and next weekend. I said to my church this week, historically, the surveys show that this week there will be fewer people in church nationwide than any other Sunday. Then Labor Day weekend is number two. People get that first vacation in on Memorial Day, get that last vacation in on Labor Day. It's actually my least favorite time to vacation because everything is so crowded. But guess where I'm going to be? On vacation down in the dirty Myrtle. So it's vacation season and everyone's about to take off to do various things. And so that got me thinking, as an American where I live, with this very unique thing. I know this doesn't sound right, but listen to me. Vacations are unique. They're new. It's not normal in human history or worldwide right now for a middle-class person to have a vacation. I understand that the French get a month off and that the Brits take a month off. Most European countries have these paid situations. They're very weird. They're a very small percentage of the world. You think of them as big because they've been big historically, but it's something less than 10% of the planet's population lives, I'm now picturing a map, from Britain all the way over to Ukraine. It's a very small group of people. You think they're talking about vacation destinations in the majority of Latin America, Africa, and Asia? Yeah, there's some wealth in Taiwan and Japan and some parts of China, but not. You think there's a whole bunch of villagers? There's some seaside fishermen in China thinking about their vacation destination. So what I want to talk about briefly is vacationing to the glory of God, because we are in vacation season. And what we don't want them to be are these made-up things that got made up in the last couple hundred years where we escape all of our responsibilities and get to just check out for no reason whatsoever. We want them to be more than that. The Christian wants to glorify God in all things, use all things for our sanctification. So I wrote down, 1, 2, 3, 4, that's four. Four things to recognize about vacationing to the glory of God. One, this is the one I just said. You live in a unique time. Just recognize how spoiled you are, how spoiled I am. Recognize the blessing that you're in, that the idea of traveling to a beach or to mountains is an incredible privilege in the history of humanity. You know, we don't live in the Christian worldview is not an intersectional worldview. We don't feel sorry for privileges. We're not devastated by the fact that good things have happened to us. But do recognize that some vast group of humanity lived and died within 30 miles of where they were born, and it wasn't next to an ocean. They never got to see one of those. They didn't travel to mountains for the fun of it. They didn't get to see the big cities of the world. So just as you're going on vacation, I'll do that, I know, Saturday before we leave. I'm just going to pray right before we leave. Lord, thank you that we get to do this. Leave our cushy, awesome, incredible home and go to another very comfortable place to see this incredible thing you made, the ocean, watch the tides roll in, and enjoy leisure. So number one, recognize it as a blessing. Don't take for granted that you have this incredible blessing. Two, rest intentionally. I struggle to rest, period. So when I go on trips, I tend to be an itinerary person. My idea here is I'm going to a new place. I want to do as many things there as I can't do where I live. So I've never understood people who go on vacations and do the same things over, like they every year. Now, don't get me wrong, like not necessarily go to the same places because places change. Like I think of me growing up, we would go to the beach every year and go to the same, like whatever that place is called. So think about Broadway. Broadway at the beach, maybe. And there's at least some chance there's new stores there. Or, the items change kind of, sort of, right? But the idea of just going to eat at the same places and going to doing the same things over and over. Like, I want to do more things in the world. And so I want to go to places I haven't been. And when I do go to places I haven't been, I want to make sure I do the things there that I don't have the opportunity to do where I live. I just struggle in general to rest. But some of you don't. You're good at it. You're good at letting your mind and your body check out and do nothing. And I just want to encourage you to have some intention for that. That it's not just the absence of work, but the preparation for better work. It's not just the presence of inactivity, the presence of some kind of lethargy, but instead the presence of preparation to go do the things they have to get done. A friend of mine, Adam, and I have talked for years about how we often come back from vacations unrested. To the point where I like to have shorter vacations in my location where I'm going, and then come back and have just a day at home to vacation for my vacation and actually get the recharge that I wanted in the first place. Well, and why? Why are we resting on purpose? Because there's work to do. There's work to do in our houses, in the places where we work, in our vocations, in our churches, in our communities. There's work to do. So, man, I'm going to use this vacation to be grateful for it. I also want to rest intentionally, not just the absence of things to do that I got to do, but the presence of preparation. I want to come back feeling good, come back feeling healthy, having energy, because the Lord has given me blessed work to do. So, number one, just know you are blessed in it. Two, be intentional about your rest. Three, I actually put in here also then, people like me, use it for the work the Lord has given. You know, I thought about my vacations as a younger man when my boys were 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, those ages. We had a good system back then because they kind of had three dad figures between me, my elder brother, and our dad so that we could take shifts. And, you know, my dad could take them early and then I'd take a shift and my big brother would take a shift and they could be entertained and cared for all day. Because we had so many folks involved. But those were times of great connection and good memories and times we still bring up. And I hope to use this trip I'm about to go on for being connected, building memories that you can anchor on in the future, to be a good example of my married into family, a good example of what being a caring, attentive husband looks like for now new nieces and nephews. I want them to see it modeled well. I'm going to use this time to the glory of God to use the time for the good work that He's placed before me. My first job isn't at North Greeley University. My first job isn't even at the church that I love at Beechwood. My first job is to love my wife, to be a good example of salt and light in the world, and use it for that too. So be grateful for it. Rest with intention. Three, use it for the work that God has placed for you and your family. And then the lesson I wrote down was, It's not a imperative for you. The one I wrote down was why this started to weigh on me. I'm prepping to continue to work through the Epistle to the Hebrews in the month of June at Beechwood. I'm also reading Matt Chandler's book right now called The Overcomers. And those two things coincided to make me really understand more, and it's weighing on me, it's heavy, to understand more of the story in which I am entangled, the story in which I am involved. I'm prepping for Hebrews 11. It's called the Hall of Faith, and it's the stories of Abel and Enoch, Abraham, Moses, lots of people that the writer just says, by faith, these people did these things. And then I read the Chandler book that says, has this great line, how's it go? You were made for these times, and these times were made for you. And so then I started thinking about the characters in Hebrews 11. For Abraham was made for his time when God would call him out. And he was made for his time, and those times were made for him. Pharaoh and powerful Egypt were made as the proving ground for Moses to have the faith that he needed, and Aaron to have the faith that he needed. And God made them for that time. The time was made for them. And I'm starting to feel, I think properly, correctly, more and more like their story is a precursor to all of ours. Not that they're fundamentally separate. The American discipleship I received said, you got to write your own story. Everybody get up and write your own story. Write your own professional and relational and romantic stories. Write your own financial story. Everyone's got to be the author of their own book. And I just don't see that anymore. I have now this weight that these characters that I'm thinking about, they were responsible for the things God gave them to do, and they did them. And they did them looking off into the future, knowing, I will have descendants that are going to have to do the same thing. God's going to make challenges and times for them, and they're going to have to step up. There's going to come a time where, I think about, I don't know, I'm imagining now Moses doing what God called him to do, knowing there could come a time where we're actually going to get into this land that God called us to, and there's going to be a generation of unfaithful people, and some powerful nation is going to come and drag a lot of us away. That happened with Babylon. And that generation that gets dragged away, that's the time God made for them, and I want them to step up to the plate, step up to their time, and be the people that have the faith to meet the challenge. And you know what? Daniel did. Daniel was there. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they were there. The times were made for Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they were made for them. So it's just starting to weigh that I have my little part of this big story. It's a very tiny part, but I just want to be faithful in it. I thought, man, I guess this is just getting older. I started thinking about my granddad more, especially my dad's dad. I don't know if he ever did, but what, I mean, if he was an intergenerational thinker like I'm becoming, don't you think about your grandsons? And he was a missionary in China and in Africa, wanting them to be faithful followers of Jesus. I almost started to feel like an obligation to my ancestors, like my actual bloodline ancestors, but also my Christian ancestors. You guys did fight your fight, some of you less effectively than others. But I better do my part then, and train my boys and the generation behind me to do their part when I'm gone. And that leads me then to start thinking, oh, I better even take my vacation spiritually seriously. Because everything is to the glory of God. Sola, de la, gloria, all to the glory of God alone. Okay. I know that's a lot of intensity about going on vacation. But let me encourage you to do it on purpose. That's what you get on the show. You get a lot of intensity around biblical things. At least I hope you do. Not needlessly intense, but we try to take it very seriously, including some work I've been doing the last 2 years on the show, trying to understand some hard things to understand in the Bible. We talk about God's good law and how it works in the world, and we're trying to figure out how to make it work in this modern world as well. That gets hard because often we will read odd laws in the Bible. I often talk about the one that has to do with what happens when someone's ox gores another person, and then we got to come up with some kind of just system for that. I understand that sounds irrelevant for you. You probably have not been gored by an ox, but the modern day equivalent might have happened to you, and I believe the modern day equivalent might be getting hurt in a car accident or getting hurt at work. Either one of those things, I know they're a very big deal. They're very severe because the medical bills pile up at the same time you're losing wages. While those two things are happening, you're just trying to navigate the process of getting justice. And so I don't want you to be intimidated by all that. Don't want you to be scared of it. There are people out there who can help you. The one I want you to call on is a personal friend of mine. His name is Samuel Harms, as in stay out of harm's way. That's H-A-R-M-S. You can Google him, or his number is 864-666-6666. His name is Samuel Harms, attorney at law. He is right here in Greenville at, let me find that, 33 Market Point Drive, Greenville, South Carolina, 29607. His number is 666-6666. For real, don't try to do it alone. Reach out to somebody who can help. I would suggest Samuel Harms at 864-666-6666. If you have been gored by the modern day ox, or that is, hurt in a car accident or hurt at work, give Samuel Harms a call today. These last three things. Two things. I do want to keep this show shorter, and I don't know if I'm doing it. I want to go straight politics for a little bit. That's not a different category than biblical thinking. It's just now moving to a different subcategory, I guess. And answer this question. Why is Donald Trump winning? Because he is, man. I like poll aggregation. Individual polls are harder to trust, not because people have... Everyone's self-interest is to be right, right? So your pollsters out there don't want to be wrong. They don't have an agenda in their polling strategy. But it's hard. It's a hard thing to do. Trying to use 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 respondents to extrapolate what the actions of what will ultimately be probably be 120, 130 million people, what they'll do in 6 months. About 6 months from now is the election. Closer to 5 months. Trying to use 5,000 respondents to determine what 130 million people will do is hard. That's a hard science. But on all of them, from the Harvard Harris to the New York Times, Siena, to Reuters and Gallup, everybody has got Trump up, and sometimes convincingly, especially in the six states that will determine this election. I think this is just good, fun knowledge for you to have. Six states will determine this election. Three are called Rust Belt states. It's where all our manufacturing used to be before it all moved south. That is Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. If you can picture those on the map up in the Midwest, at the very top there, they all border Canada. Actually, Pennsylvania doesn't border Canada. So Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, that's the Rust Belt. And then there's the Sun Belt states. That's Georgia, Arizona, Nevada. So picture that. That's not all, quote, in the south, but the southern part of the United States. And all of those were very close the last two election cycles. Those six states will determine the election outcome. And in those states in particular, Trump's doing quite well, except in Pennsylvania and in Michigan. Those are pretty tight. But the question here that I just had, why is it like that? And I have come up with two reasons, one more intriguing than the other. Reason one, Trump's not in our faces. And so I think a lot of people have forgotten how abrasive and how unlikable he is, because he's not on Twitter. His choice to use Truth Social is so beneficial to him, because people have a chance to forget about him, and they'll forget that he's kind of abrasive and that they don't like him personally. And then also, he doesn't know how much of a blessing his criminal trial is, because not only is he not tweeting, he can't go do a lot of stuff. He's got to be in court. And so everyone can just kind of forget that he exists a little bit, and that puts a lot of pressure on the current president of the United States, and we're just finding the polling that people generally don't like him and don't think he's up to the job. So that's one reason, is Trump's just not in the limelight, and that's so it's helpful to him. But I think this one is the much more intriguing reason. Being a politics nerd since I was 13, the idea of political realignments are fascinating to me. Did you know that the entire South was Democratic Party ruled until starting in the 70s when it started to change, and it took about 20 years, and you'll find that 1994 was the year everything clicked finally. And even here in South Carolina, it was a lot of party switching. It wasn't Republicans defeated Democrats in elections in 94 in our state, in the state legislature. You had enough Democrats switch parties that it became a Republican state. That happened a lot in the South. That's fascinating. Like, just that kind of turnover, the movements that caused that. And I think we're headed towards something like that. So let me give you a narrative. Since the civil rights movements of the 60s, the amount of people that saw the world through an ethnic lens first began to diminish, both black and white and everything else. The idea of, judged by the content of the character and of the color of your skin, was an ascendant idea for everyone, and the judged by the color of your skin idea was in descent. And so you saw slowly, very slowly, less racially polarized voting over time. I mean, you saw that big time in 2008. A considered the first black president, won the closest thing you can to a landslide in a very polarized country. I mean, it wasn't a landslide, but it's as close as you can get. And then starting in 2012, with the rise of lots of things, including widespread use of smartphones, so that it made it seem that, for example, like police brutality, which is a problem, was a much bigger problem than it actually is when it comes to interactions with police and black citizens. I think Barack Obama's cynical use of race to try to drum up and increase his vote totals. And then just some of the, you saw it, I mean, a lot of the racial reckoning things that happened in the news over that 10 years, we saw a resurgence of racial identity first. The most important thing you are is your ethnicity. That is what you should be first. Now that some of that madness, some of the fever is descending, people are coming to a different identity, and it was the one that was growing. While ethnic identity was diminishing since the civil rights movement, the identity that was increasing over time was people's income. It was a keeping up with the Joneses thing. The 80s were a very materialistic time where technological advancement was a big part of status symbol, what devices you had in your house and what appliances you were getting. And so income group and economic standing was starting to replace ethnic standing in a lot of people's minds. And then again, ethnicity took its 2012, went on about a 10-year run of being the most important thing to everybody. But I think what's happening is we are receding back to the mean, the median, the previous pattern to be seen first in your income group. And we're now just seeing all the economic data. People are struggling. I mean, we're talking, was it 2 out of 10 Americans have maxed out credit cards, as in they have hit their limit, or I think the definition of that is 90% of their limit. And then you just start talking about when your wages have gone up. That's awesome, great, but not at the rate of inflation. And so people are hurting economically. And so you're seeing the numbers for Donald Trump for ethnic minorities skyrocket. I mean, he's at 20 and 25% in some polls for black voters. He's up at 35, 40% for Hispanic voters. And why? Is that an ethnic thing? No, it's that those ethnic identities are diminishing while people are recognizing their economic identity. Now, also, let me say, while that one might be healthier for a people, still not a great one. I mean, we've got some good proverbs here about not judging for good or ill someone by their financial situation. We don't assume of the rich that God loves them more. We don't assume of the poor that they're just not in God's favor, or we don't even assume of the poor that they're lazy. We don't assume of the rich that they're hardworking and upstanding. That's in this world, at least, that's not how it always works. So that's not a good identity either, but it is me giving you an interpretive analysis and interpretive lens for something happening in the world around you. There's a realignment happening. Why? What is it? I think it has to do with just economics. People are seeing themselves first now as their financial situation. And people are having trouble paying the rent, paying the mortgage, getting the groceries, sending the kids to daycare, private school. And I think that is redounding. I think that's the word. Redounding to the benefit of the most recent previous president of the United States. Which will lead me to my final point today. And the one that brings me the most joy, because I think it's funny. Someone was asking me to handicap the upcoming election, and I want to give you a scenario that I think is very plausible. The state of Nebraska has historically awarded, that makes me want to give a shout out over to the Westminster Doxology podcast, because sometimes they have their resident Nebraskan there, their Lutheran Nebraskan. John Ross is over there. But they're one of the weird states. Only Maine and Nebraska do it this way. They award their electoral college votes by congressional district. So it's a very small state, only 5 electoral college votes. That means they have 2 senators. Now, this is getting deep on Nebraska, but they have 2 senators and then 3 congressional districts. So if you're a presidential candidate, if you win the whole state, you get 2 votes, then you have to win individual congressional districts to win the other votes. Historically, Nebraska has been all five of those votes go to the Republican candidate. All their congressional districts have been for the Republican candidate. I believe it was the last two elections, one district, the one where their big city is, I think Lincoln maybe, has gone to the Democratic candidate. Nebraska's very heavily controlled Republican legislature is in process of making it a winner-take-all state. I think they will get there before the 2024 election, meaning all five votes would go to Donald Trump. In that situation, this is how easy it would be. In a situation where Nebraska does that, you go back to my six states, the Rust Belt and the Sun Belt. Here's how easy it would be. If Trump wins the Sun Belt, Nevada, Arizona, Georgia, where he's favored, and then Biden wins Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, the Rust Belt, where Biden is more likely to do better up north. That's a 269 to 269 tie. We know where all the other states are going, assuming the map that we all understand, that Ohio and North Carolina stay Republican states, and assuming that New Hampshire and New Mexico stay blue states. Assume that. It's this easy. Nebraska passed that law, and then Trump win the Sun Belt, Biden win the Rust Belt. It's 269-269. Which leads us to a very entertaining scenario. What happens then? I looked it up to make sure I was right. Here's how it works. The House of Representatives would then elect the president, not with each one of them having one vote, but each state delegation having a vote. So it wouldn't be 435 members of the new Congress all coming in and they all get one vote. The seven members of the House of Representatives for South Carolina would get together and they would be able to cast one South Carolina vote for whoever they want. And the 52 members of the House that are all from California, they'd get together and they would cast one vote for President of the United States. I looked, and right now, the congressional delegation count is 26 to 24 for the Democrats. It's that close. The likelihood is that, at least by the current polling, is that Democrats would actually have a 27 to 23 lead after this upcoming election. But also projected is that Republicans will take the Senate. So get this. The president is elected by state delegations in the House, but not the vice president. The vice president is actually chosen by the Senate, and it actually is the 100 senators who vote. So here's the best setup for a sitcom I could ask for. Like, I want this show to be made. The House of Representatives gets together, and they get to vote for Biden because it's majority Democrat state delegations. But then the Republican-controlled Senate could choose whoever they want as vice president. And they choose Trump, and it'd be very funny. It's not actually funny. It's funny in the sitcom situation. But they actually could do that. They're allowed. In a tie, that's how you choose the president and the vice president. They could actually choose Biden's vice president for him. They could make it me if they wanted. They could make it any Republican figure. And come on, at least in our ridiculous political world. I know a lot of it, you can bemoan it, we can be sad about it, we can be upset, be angry. Sometimes they're just so comical and all so stupid and laughable. I think it's appropriate sometimes just to laugh at them and how funny it would be. And you should know that, little piece of American trivia. That is one of the scenarios, that the House could choose the president of one party, the Senate could choose the vice president from another party, and then let the writers of season 2025 of America write the script, because that could be an entertaining thing. All right, that's it for me. There should be more on this feed this week. If Mr. Cody Fields and I get together, we've got some things we want to talk about, so keep an eye on this feed for more. And as always, feedback is appreciated. You can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or Threads. Look for Corey Truax. You can also email the show at CoreyTruaxShow@gmail.com, CoreyTruaxShow@gmail.com. And if the Lord allows, I'll be back with another new edition of the Corey Truax Show next week. Until then, everybody, peace and love.